Welcome to episode 42 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm talking to Harold Trinkunas, who is Senior Research Scholar and Associate Director at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Did I get all that right?
That's right, Brett.
All right. So among other things, he's done a lot of research on Venezuela, including a book on civil-military relations. But what I'm actually going to focus on for the purposes of the podcast is that last week he gave testimony at a hearing for the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee on the House Foreign Affairs Committee about Venezuela. So, Harold, thank you so much for doing this.
It's a pleasure to join you, Greg.
All right. So I'm going to start with the question I always ask everyone, and that is, what first got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, I was born in Maracaibo, Venezuela, and I grew up in Venezuela. So I got to graduate school with a sort of a built-in natural advantage in speaking fluent Spanish and knowing something about the region. I'd always been interested in politics. And I was going around talking to potential advisors my first quarter of the PhD program here at Stanford, and I happened to talk to Terry Carl. Political science professor at Stanford, now retired, had done a lot of work on Venezuela's political economy,
right,
as well as on democratization with Philippe Schmitter and Guillermo O'Donnell and Lawrence Whitehead and so on and so forth, looked at me and said, I bet you could get the military to talk to you in Venezuela. That's what you should do. You should go talk to the military. I bet, you know, with your background, you could actually do some research. And it turned out to be true. So that's what got me started on Latin American politics as a direction, comparative politics as a subdiscipline, and civil military relations as the subject of sort of my first book.
Okay, cool. So your own background in Venezuela kind of gave you the street cred with the military, then.
And that was part of it. The other thing was my parents had both worked in the oil industry, and my father still worked in the oil industry at that time. And the oil industry and the military in Venezuela work closely together in many parts of the country, especially in rural areas. So the fact that I could use some family connections to get military officers to actually talk to me. And then, of course, the interviews snowball, as you know yourself from
exactly,
field work.
Okay, so talking about this, the hearing, which I read the three testimonies, I thought it was really interesting for a number of reasons. So the title was The Venezuela Crisis, The Malicious Influence of State and Criminal Actors, which seemed to mean to me, what horrible things are other states doing in Venezuela? And I just want to get your impression. Did you feel like the committee was fishing, or was it straightforward?
I think there was definitely a bit of fishing going on. The committee chairman, Congressman Duncan, and the ranking member, Congressman Cyrus, a Democrat from New Jersey, are both sort of very critical of Cuba. They're very critical of Maduro's regime in Venezuela. They were critical of President Chavez before that. And so they definitely are trying to frame the issue in a particular way. I was invited by the committee staff, essentially from the Democratic side of the committee. The way these hearings usually are put together is that the majority, in this case, Republicans, gets to pick two witnesses, and the minority, the Democrats, gets to pick one. And so I also thought the title was, entirely too binary. So that's why, if you read my testimony, I actually use, the negative influence of some external actors. I try to reframe the issue a little bit, because I do think, obviously, there's some negative effects occurring as a result of the configuration of the President Maduro's relationship with some of these countries, but I don't think that is necessarily permanent, nor is it necessarily malicious. So I wanted to add some nuance and some context by testifying.
And so even before getting to the substance, too, what was the vibe at the hearing? I mean, was it sort of extremely negative in general? Was it receptive to try to think about new ideas, or what kind of impression did you get?
Well, it's certainly the committee is quite negative about Venezuela. Not all of it. There are some members, especially on the Democratic side, that take a more nuanced view. That said, I think people are very concerned about the situation of Venezuela, the economic crisis, the humanitarian crisis, refugee flows. And there's also a certain amount of, certainly on the right, concern about sort of the military security, armed non-state actor, organized crime dimensions of all this as well. So I'd say the experts I was testifying with would tended to be more on the very concerned about the security dimension of what was going on.
And I guess I didn't see the whole video. Did you get grilled? Or do you feel like you got grilled?
I thought it went pretty well. I think, I'd like to think I was the most reasonable person on the panel. But some of my colleagues who I know Kiko Toro and everybody
Yeah.
knows pretty well, might disagree. But no, I thought there were some serious questions. I was allowed to give answers. You only have each Congress person only has 5 minutes, so it's the norm is to be polite and try to be direct and concise in your answers.
Right.
We're not always successful, but no, I thought I got space to make the points I wanted to make about the nuance in the relationships of these different actors with Venezuela.
Okay, now thinking about the substance. So the focus really was Cuba, Russia, and China. And so in your opinion, to what degree has Cuba's influence changed or not changed as Venezuela's resources have dried up?
So it for the current regime in Cuba, for President Raul Castro and before him for Fidel Castro, they do have a vital national interest in maintaining good relations with Venezuela. Not only is there the access to subsidized financing for oil, the Doctors for Oil program, but there's also the security relationship as well. Now, that said, we do have to keep in mind that trade between Venezuela and Cuba was over $7 billion a year back in 2012, 2013, and that's diminished to about $2.2 billion now. So given that one of the ways Cuba makes foreign it earns foreign currency is by exporting professionals like doctors. So I think we could probably guess that some of the doctors have been withdrawn just because they would have been sent elsewhere in the world if Venezuela is not paying as much as it used to.
Go ahead if you.
No, and I would just say that there was also the discussion in the panel. I mean, there's a the Cubans had played a more prominent role in the Venezuelan military and the Venezuelan intelligence services in the past under Chavez. Some have claimed, including Francisco Toro, who was on the panel, that that relationship has diminished in the sense the Venezuelan military is so much more important to the survival of President Maduro than it was to President Chavez, that the military is part of the bargaining process has basically pushed the Cubans further away from sort of core military interests. And so the Cubans are not present in military units in the way they were in the past.
Okay. And now thinking of Russia and China, in your testimony, you argue that Russia and China in particular act primarily as enablers. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Basically, what Russia and China provide is capabilities that the Maduro regime does not have. Venezuela cannot produce its own advanced weapon systems. Russia can provide them. Russia can also provide the financing to purchase these weapon systems. Venezuela needs infrastructure. China knows how to build infrastructure. The Maduro regime needs access to consumer goods to satisfy its support base. China can provide those in quantity, along with the financing to make it possible. So there is just the very strictly, they provide capabilities that Venezuela doesn't have. But there's another dimension to this, which is they also allow the regime to pursue policies that, have costs associated with them, perhaps for longer than otherwise might be possible, and also over the objection of domestic constituencies. Foreign workers are less of a political liability than the local professionals or workers. So Cuban doctors are not likely to protest against the regime's policies in the healthcare area, whereas Venezuelan doctors probably would, and in fact do. So in that way, they also let the regime do what it wants at a lower cost, the domestic political cost, if to frame it that way.
And I was thinking too of China. I wondered, because China can be framed very negative. It's trying to establish itself in the Western Hemisphere, etc. Or, I mean, does it seem like China, in part, wants to avoid regime change because that would just mess up debt repayment, or potentially?
It could. I mean, I actually think that China's interests, especially if you look at the larger Latin America context, and I know there's a debate about this, there's a lot of economic interest being driving there. I also think there's just the Chinese didn't fully realize the risk that they were running in lending to Venezuela. You've seen some cases in Africa where the Chinese also have a heavy presence, where they've also made some bad bets. So I think they're just climbing the learning curve of interacting with Latin America. Certainly there's many foreign investors who have gotten stiffed by Latin American countries in the history of the region. So the Chinese interests are primarily economic. That said, of all the external actors, the Chinese strike me as the most pragmatic. They're the ones who have actually talked to the opposition and maintained regular contact. And the opposition has by and large been smart enough in Venezuela to signal to the Chinese that they wouldn't consider Chinese debt odious debt as something that they would repudiate. In fact, they kind of know that China is going to have to be part of the mix of Venezuela's economic recovery going forward, just because the scale of funds that Venezuela would need, the Venezuelan economist Ricardo Hausmann has estimated up to $100 billion, is going to be something that even the IMF might have a little bit of trouble with. So I think they just want to make sure that they get repaid.
Right, right. And it sort of followed up that too with Russia, because Russia seems to be plowing money in now, and I feel like Putin he already knows what he's getting into. Does that seem more political or a mix of political and economic?
Well, to be clear, it's really Rosneft, which is an international oil company at this point that's plowing money in, and they seem to be thinking that they're picking up, you know, Venezuelan oil assets for pennies on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
That this is just a long-term bet to acquire these assets on the cheap. I mean, Venezuela still has plenty of oil. Venezuela's dwindling oil production is not because of a lack of reserves. It's because of a lack of investment. Because of Venezuela's debt schedule and the price of oil, basically what the regime has done is dramatically contracted consumption in Venezuela by reducing imports. And it has dramatically shrunk its spending on oil infrastructure. And if you don't regularly invest in your oil infrastructure, then production declines. And they're doing this to meet their international debt obligations.
Right. And one thing that that called my attention when I was reading over the testimony is that I really like the quote that you said, we should avoid overconnecting the dots. Explain more about what that means for you.
Well, as you know, Greg, as you know, there's this there's a lot of conspiracy theories about external actors in Latin America, the relationship with Iran or China or Russia or Hezbollah, which also came up during the hearing. And I tend to be skeptical, especially of these conspiracy theories that do connect all these dots, that claim there's some sort of international coordinated conspiracy against the United States, that these actors are all working together. I think that, you know, Occam's razor, these countries all have an economic interest in working with Venezuela. They each have seen an advantage to doing so at certain times, and those interests vary. So, for example, I gave the example of Iran during the hearing, which, you know, has been seen as, you know, there's been conspiracy theorizing around the Iran-Venezuela relationship. But, you know, I just pointed out that, in fact, Iran and Venezuela are now economic competitors. So there's reasons to think the relationship is not as close. Iran has not listened to Venezuela's calls for OPEC to reduce oil production. Since sanctions were lifted on Iran last year under the JCPOA agreement, they've been trying to reclaim market share that Venezuela had taken. So, you know, that's what I mean, is that we have to understand that each of these actors has individual reasons for being involved in Venezuela. It doesn't require a conspiracy to explain them.
Yeah, and I feel like it's sort of the other side of the coin of this is that avoiding overconnecting the dots often relates to U.S.-Latin American relations, because the U.S., there's always this sense that the U.S. is conspiring here, there, and everywhere, and oftentimes your reality is totally different. that, you
No.
know, that the U.S. is, whatever's happening in X country may, isn't something that the U.S. government is paying close attention to at this moment and trying to plot against.
Well, exactly. And it's even hard to argue that if within the U.S. government there's enough coordination going on among the different agencies to make these to pull off these conspiracies. Sometimes the point I make when talking to colleagues in Latin America or people who make these kinds of claims is, Latin America is like issue number 10 of a list of 10 things that Washington's thinking about on any given day, and Washington has enough bandwidth for about two, right? And the other thing, but you understand the logic for experts in sort of countries in the region where the U.S. is, has played an influential role. They're paying attention to the United States 70 or 80% of the time, whereas the U.S. is paying attention to them 2 or 3% of the time. So the level, it's very asymmetrical levels of interest and focus between the two sides.
And I like the idea of Occam's razor too, because if you look for the simplest explanation, it's often going to make much more sense than the more convoluted things that you end up with otherwise. You mentioned the need for like U.S. policy prescriptions. The need for greater engagement with the Caribbean, which Hugo Chavez showered with aid of various types. And it seems like right now, too, that's especially pressing given the hurricanes that are battering the region. What hope do you have that the administration and Congress, and/or Congress, will heed that advice?
Well, this is part of a long-running debate, which relates to the role of the Caribbean in Venezuela's foreign policy strategy and in U.S. foreign policy strategy, and in the ability of the United States to do anything about what's going on in Venezuela. The argument has been that really the way to address the situation in Venezuela is to go to the Organization of American States. That's the regional organization that has the credibility and it has a role in international law, especially through the Inter-American Democratic Charter, to deal with issues such as deteriorating democracy in Venezuela. But the Caribbean has been a major obstacle. It has a lot of votes, even though these are, quite small countries. So the U.S. in various ways has tried to pull the Caribbean away from supporting Venezuela, but they've never invested the resources. So if you look back at the Obama administration, the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative was part of what they proposed to help the Caribbean become more energy self-sufficient. But there was no money in it. Basically, it was an exercise in convincing the private sector to invest in Caribbean energy and convince the Caribbean countries to homogenize their regulations to create a more attractive investment environment. But there's no real resources. There's no hard cash the way the Venezuelans are handing out. The committee is well aware of this problem, and they've been pushing the administration, the Obama administration, now the Trump administration, to actually do more in this area. And it strikes me that for relatively small expenditures, you could actually do a lot to help the Caribbean become more energy self-sufficient, but also to recover from these hurricanes. That said, it seems like Washington is pretty skeptical about foreign aid these days, so I can't say that I have a lot of hope.
And you might not know the answer to this, but what does Petrocaribe look like these days?
Well, the price of oil is too low for the financing assistance to kick in. So it really, I think, has about $50 or $60 a barrel before Venezuela starts, subsidizing.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
And so, but there is other elements of Petrocaribe. There's schemes involving loans or trade in kind, which is important for some of these countries. Also, the kind of money associated with it tends to go directly to the prime minister or to the chief executive, so that's kind of attractive funding. You don't have to go to the legislature of your own country to organize projects. So, and there's probably some residual loyalty. I mean, if I was the head of a Caribbean state and the United States was asking me to change my vote at the OAS, I'd want to see, show me the funding, show me the foreign assistance, show me the project, and before I would sort of cut off my ties to Venezuela. So even if Venezuela is not providing a lot of assistance right now, there's value in that vote in a certain sense. That's what they're bargaining with.
And you end your testimony by mentioning targeted sanctions. What's the problem with broader sanctions, and how do you think targeted sanctions might work better.
Well, this is part of the overall debate on, how to achieve influence over the situation in Venezuela. And generally, I'm fairly skeptical of sanctions being able to work, just because what we know about sanctions in theory is, and in practice too, is that really it's the more external stakeholders are on board with sanctions, the more impact they have on the targeted country. Sanctions worked in Iran, or at least some claim, because there was this large group of countries that supported the sanctions. So it's going to be tough in Venezuela to make general sanctions work. Also, I mean, Francisco Toro on the panel pointed out it's a hunger strategy, right? And this is a country that already is hungry. I mean, it's gone from 32% of people living in poverty 4 years ago to over 80% living in poverty today. Rates of malnutrition are rising. So it puts the general population at great risk when it already is in a humanitarian crisis. Targeted sanctions are designed to modify behavior. Now, they can also induce defiance. I mean, we know from political science research that sanctions, or shaming only work to change behavior if the target feels like they want to be part of the in-group of the community that shares the set of norms. If they don't, which I argue is the case in Venezuela, then the reaction is defiance. So I actually think of the targeted sanctions slightly differently, which is general sanctions are designed to cut off the money coming into Venezuela. Targeted sanctions against government officials are designed to modify the behavior of government officials, though, as I just said, it might induce defiance, and in fact, so far has. The other place where targeted sanctions can happen is in the support infrastructure that helps corrupt government officials in Venezuela squirrel away their money. And that's in the banking system, in the construction and trading, and so on and so forth. Those are the potential targets. And it's very interesting. FinCEN, which is the U.S. government's agency for enforcing these kinds of for dealing with these intelligence around international financial transactions, has just put out a warning on Venezuela, including a long list of things. Ways of identifying corrupt Venezuelan money and keeping it out of the U.S. banking system. So clearly, somebody's thinking about this at some level.
And then I'll just conclude by asking, to what degree do you think sanctions of any kind are going to have a decisive, by the U.S. anyway, have a decisive impact on political outcomes in Venezuela?
I think that the real issue in Venezuela is that this is a regime with a very high cost of exit. There's officials who are corrupt, there's officials who violate human rights, there's officials who are tied to drug trafficking. And as we know from studies of democratic transitions, we both have engaged with this literature. It's really the when the regime comes apart, when the seams develop, when the splits that you start getting a transition, the moderates get together and envision a new arrangement. The problem, of course, is that the risks of exit are so high that it's very hard to build the deem moderates to find it credible that they could have a future inside Venezuela, right? And so sanctions can adjust some of the costs and some of the incentive structures faced by the actors. But really, from my view, it's the Venezuelan opposition has and the potential moderates in the regime have not figured out how to commit to some sort of outcome which would allow a transition to happen. So I think right now it's really domestic economic factors that are going to be the variable that dominates now. The political side of things has died down now that protests have receded in Venezuela.
Right. Well, with that, we are out of time. I've been talking to Harold Chinkunis, who's Senior Research Scholar and Associate Director at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Harold, thank you so much.
Greg, it's been a pleasure.